Oh, right.
Okay, we'll get started.
You were not here.
So thanks for coming out, even with the impending doom upon us. So this evening is the third of our three-part lecture on the makings of modern Judaism. So let me briefly recap the first two for you. Some of you were here for both, some of you were here for one, for some of you it's your first. So let's briefly give you an overview of what we've covered already, and then we'll get into the topic for this evening, which is Neo-Orthodoxy. So in our first lecture, we looked at the rise of the Reform movement, and we pointed to the roots of this movement really lying in the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, and with a focus primarily on the world of education, this educational reform, how Jews are educated, what they're learning, the inclusion of more secular studies into the way in which Jews are being educated, and then to aesthetic reforms, to changes in synagogue service, synagogue ritual, that focus on the sounds and sights, what the ritual looks like, what the rabbi is wearing, the language that they're speaking, where they're placing the bima, decorum, music, order, ceremony. Those are the kinds of things that were really the beginnings of a movement towards a reform movement. We noted that in 1818 there was a watershed event, as this group in Hamburg was not the first, but was the most significant group to come together to try to create a shul around these kinds of ideas. The New Israelite Temple Association in Hamburg provokes a rather strong response, one that the Hamburg Beit Din will go out and seek help for from the Gedolim, the great rabbinic authorities of Western Europe and Central Europe. And so 1818 becomes a flashpoint in and around Hamburg, where both this nascent reform group now is getting attention and is now sort of coalescing in and of itself, as is a reactionary group of traditionalists. We noted that in the decades that came, in the 1820s, the 1830s, you'll have other small pockets who will try and imitate what was happening in Hamburg, but it really won't be until the 1840s that these group of rabbis, particularly with the leadership of a man by the name of Abraham Geiger, will come together in the 1840s for their first set of rabbinical conferences to begin to flesh out, but what is this that we're really talking about? What is it that we believe? What does reform or reformed Judaism look like? And it's after the 1840s, with the energy both from these conferences, the coalescence that resulted as a result, and also a turn in the governments of Europe from a more conservative bent to a more liberal bent in the second half of the 19th century, that the reform movement will really come into its own, in the sense that it will almost formally take a position where it says that halacha and halachic literature are a repository of Jewish values, of Jewish history, of Jewish heritage, but not a binding legal system that ought to dictate how a Jew lives his or her life each and every single day, and a sense that Judaism was, always has been, and is intended to be something which changes with the times, right, that meets the sensibilities of a particular time. But that's what begins to emerge in the second half of the 19th century. That was lecture number one. Lecture number two, we went back in time to that moment in 1818 and looked at what resulted in the traditional world in response to this growing reform movement. We talked about this movement known today as ultra-Orthodoxy. I want to be clear, when I talk about ultra-Orthodoxy, I'm not using the New York Times definition of ultra-Orthodoxy, which is, right, anybody with a black hat and a jacket, right, is ultra-Orthodox. I don't mean that. I'm talking about where did those communities today that really are quite insular, quite isolationist in their ideology. You'll find them in certain areas in Israel, in Geula, Me'esharim, Bnei Brak, in certain areas of the United States, a little less so, but you'll find them in certain areas of Brooklyn, Muncie. That's the community that I'm really talking about, tracing the roots of that community. And again, some will trace it back to 1818 and to that moment in Hamburg, and particularly the rise, the
It's recording.
It's okay. And particularly the rise of...
Rabbi Sinensky asked me to take pictures.
The rise of a man by the name of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, who had been rising to prominence already, was called on to respond to what happened in 1818, but he really becomes the vocal and outspoken leader of the traditional community in Western Central Europe, Central Europe in particular, in the 1820s, 1830s, and we noted that often people point to a particular line in the writings of the Chassam Sofer. What line was that? We looked at it last time. Hachadash asur min haTorah. Right, Hachadash asur min haTorah. That anything that is new is forbidden, which we noted is a play on words, a very clever play on words, actually referring to Chadash, the actual isur of new grain, being asur min haTorah, meaning as opposed to it being derabanan, it's deoraita, it's min haTorah. So, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah B'chol Makom. B'chol Makom means geographic places, right? Not at all times. But that's the way the Chassam Sofer was. He was very witty that way. And there's no question that he was the unparalleled leader of the traditional world. But what is questionable is the degree to which he actually espoused an ideology that is in line with what we would call ultra-Orthodoxy today. That really seems to emerge a little bit later on. Once the students of the Chassam Sofer begin to migrate into the areas of the Carpathian Mountains, in the 1840s, 1850s, and ultimately the 1860s, we see that group begin to coalesce. We look at the Psak Din of Michalovce, which is a seminal moment in which many of these rabbis gather together. We looked at the nature of the Psak that comes out of the 1860s, which is very harsh in its tone. We begin to see Piskei Halacha that say that any kind of change, any kind of imitating the Gentiles is something which perhaps one should be Yaharig V'al Yavor, one should give up their life instead of committing. We see that people refer to it as Avodah Zara and really rather extreme terms. We see that the tone is one of a community that sees itself as under siege. Right, that they felt like they were fighting for the preservation of Judaism, right? And we noted that they had every reason to think that, right? that these groups of rabbis getting together in the 1860s in Hungary, right, couldn't see what was to come over the next 200 years. They saw a Judaism that was slipping away in certain communities. They were circling the wagons and saying, okay, the only way to protect ourselves from the dissolution of Torah Judaism completely is to dig in and say, we're not going to change anything, right? Lest it all begin to slip away. We noted at the very end of the last lecture, though, that if we look closely at what comes out of the literature of the 1860s and 1870s from this group in Eastern Hungary, it seems that the rabbis are a little bit outdated. Right? It seems like the things that they're railing against were things that the Reform movement had been doing back in 1810, in 1815, in 1818, and now it's 1860. And here they are, right, yelling about having choirs and shuls, or about having, wearing the dress of Western European non-Jewish clergy, or about having some sort of confirmation ceremony, bat mitzvah, right? Moving the bima from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul. Here they are getting all worked up about these kinds of things in the 1860s, when the Reform movement in the 1860s was having dinners, right, for their synagogue that included pork. Right, so why are they yelling about where to place the bima, right, when the Reform movement is well beyond that at that point? Right? And we pointed out what at the end?
Not for them.
Okay. Right? That we pointed out at the end of the last lecture that the truth of the matter is that the coalescence of what we will call ultra-Orthodoxy in Hungary in the 1860s and 1870s was actually not a response to the Reform movement at all. It was a response to a different movement, the Neo-Orthodox movement, is actually who they were responding to, and the very things they were talking about were the things that this movement of Western European, of German Orthodoxy had actually incorporated in their shuls already by the 1850s and 1860s, and that's that story that we're going to tell today.
First of all, I wanted to ask, would you include Lakewood in ultra-Orthodox?
I wouldn't call Lakewood one entity. I think there are different parts there. But on the whole, actually, no. I think that Lakewood is a more open place than we're talking about Bnei Brak, and we're talking about Geula Meisharim. It's a different. Most American Orthodoxy is different.
But my question, I've always wondered when the ultra Orthodox say nothing new. Nothing new compared to what? They didn't dress like Moshe Rabbeinu. They didn't do certain things that medieval Jews did.
Right.
So when they say nothing new, what's the starting point?
Now. The starting point is now. The starting point is now that we have a threat that has emerged. Right? We can't change anything.
We can't change anything from the way we do it now.
Exactly. Right.
Oh, that's right. The now.
Mm-hmm. Could you define the prefix neo? What do you mean by neo?
Sure. So neo-orthodoxy is a term that has been given to this community of German Jews because it looked different, right, than perhaps some of the traditional Judaism of years before, and we're going to describe that over the next couple of minutes together. Okay. So this world of neo-orthodoxy is generally most associated with a single individual and with a slogan that went along with this individual. And that is Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, and the slogan being Torah im Derech Eretz. So if you look at the top of page 2, top of page 2 is a selection from the writing of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch in which he is describing the purpose of the school that he is opening in Frankfurt, Germany. And he writes as follows: Judaism never remained aloof from true civilization and progress. In almost every era, its adherents were fully abreast of contemporary learning and very often excelled their contemporaries. If in recent centuries German Jews remained more or less aloof from European civilization, the fault lay not in their religion, but in the tyranny which confined them by force within the walls of their ghettos and denied them intercourse with the outside world. Our aims also include the conscientious promotion of education and culture, and we have clearly expressed this in the motto of our congregation: an excellent thing is the study of Torah combined with the ways of the world, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. So this emerges, right, as the rallying cry of neo-orthodoxy, of an approach that says we can combine secular learning, the promotion of education and culture, right, together with study of Torah, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. And so in the traditional historiography of this time, so you have, on the one hand, the Reform movement that is breaking in certain ways from traditional Judaism. You have the ultra-Orthodox community that seems to circle the wagons and say, we're not going to change at all. And then you have this community that seems to emerge in the middle, trying to take from both worlds and combine them in some sort of synthetic type of way.
Translation of Derech Eretz.
Yeah.
It's not the way we use Derech Eretz.
Okay,
yeah,
so
that's really like Torah from the world.
The same idea.
Right. So there is no question that that when Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch uses the word Derech Eretz, he does not mean Derech Eretz in the sense of moral, and the way Menschlichkeit. That's not what he means. He definitely does mean a certain worldliness. Right, his phrase that he uses time and again is called the Mensch Yisrael, and there too, Mensch not in the Yiddish version of Mensch, right, but in the German understanding of what it means to be a Mensch, a man, right. So be a Mensch Yisrael is somebody who is both a man and a Jew, a man elevated generally by their Judaism. Okay, the truth of the matter is though that history is never quite so simple. Right. And the legacy of Rav Hirsch is not as straightforward as some may make it out to be. When I used to teach at YU, I used to frame this conversation in the following way. I used to ask my students, and this was a big no-no for a historian, but it helped drive home the point. I would say to them, if Rehearse were alive today, what side of Washington Heights would he live on? Now, let me explain to those who are not familiar with the implications of that question. Let me tell you what that means. Washington Heights is the area of northern Manhattan that for half a century was dominated by two major institutions on two sides of this tiny little strip of a few blocks in northern Manhattan. On the easternmost side was Yeshiva University, still is. Yeshiva University. It dominates that part of Washington Heights. If you walked, I don't know, 10 blocks, it was up a steep hill, but to the other side of Washington Heights, you came to what used to be, this community has changed a little bit in recent years, but used to be a community dominated by a different institution known as
Breuers,
right? The Breuers Shul. That's the shul where my mother grew up. My grandparents were there. My great grandfather was a major lay leader in that world. Breuers, Washington Heights, and Breuers were synonymous for the German Orthodox community. Now, what's the significance of asking this question? Where would he live? Well, on the one hand, the Breuers Shul started by Rav Breuer, who was a grandson of Rav Hirsch. These are the descendants of Rav Hirsch. This is his community. When it transplanted from Frankfurt to the United States, that's where they came, to Washington Heights. They are his descendants in all senses of the world. On the other hand, if one went and visited the Breuers' world today, one wouldn't necessarily find the kind of openness to general studies, to secular culture, that one might have envisioned. If you want that, go to the other side of Washington Heights, to Yeshiva University. There you'll find quite explicitly a group that sees themselves ideologically as the descendants of Rav Hirsch. So let's look at that inside. So the bottom of page 2, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, former president of Yeshiva University, writes a piece in Tradition called Some Comments on Centrist Orthodoxy, and he writes as follows. What are some of our contributions to Torah Judaism, talking about the world of centrist Judaism, modern Orthodoxy? Let us adumbrate several of the more characteristic foundations of our Weltanschauung, that is, our way of looking at the world, some of which may appear more innovative and some of which are different only because of the emphasis we place upon them relative to other ideas and ideals. They deal with the general areas of education, moderation, and the people of Israel. The first is Torah Umada. That's the slogan of Yeshiva University. Torah Umada. The synthesis of Torah and worldly knowledge. For the latter term, Mada, we can just as well substitute the Hirschian Derech Eretz. Though I prefer Chochma to both. It is the term used both in the Midrash and in the writings of Maimonides. But what is this thing called Mada, or Chochma, or Rav Hirsch's Derech Eretz, according to Rabbi Dr. Lamb? For us, the study of worldly wisdom is not a concession to economic necessity. It is de jure, not de facto. I have never understood how the excuse of permitting college for the sake of parnasa, or earning a living, can be advocated by religiously serious people. If all secular learning is regarded as dangerous spiritually and forbidden halachically, what right does one have to tolerate it at all? Okay, stop there. What is Dr. Lamb saying? What is his view of Torah Umada or Torah Im Derech Eretz? It's l'chatchila, that's right. It's something that we ought to do, that everybody ought to do. It's the best of all possible situations, right? Not some sort of compromise situation that we landed up in. And we see here, explicitly, leader of Yeshiva University, probably its most articulate spokesman for this idea of Torah Umada, he wrote a book by that name, says very clearly, the roots of this are to be found where? The world of Rav Hirsch. The Torah Im Derech Eretz of Rav Hirsch. Okay, turn the page. On top of page 3, I have an excerpt from a self-described Haredi website called Dea V'Dibur from June 8th, 2005. And this, the author of this piece was writing about Rav Volbi's attitude to Torah and to Torah im Derech Eretz. And the quote goes as follows: the view of the Gaon and Tzaddik of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch Zatzal concerning Torah im Derech Eretz was understood by the Gedolei Yisrael, whose pronouncements are our authority in life, to be solely a matter of Hora'as Sha'a. This is a term used by Chazal to describe an action generally forbidden, which is allowed and mandatory under some special circumstances prevailing at the time. For example, sacrificing a korban outside the Beis HaMikdash, as Eliyahu did on Har HaKarmel. Perhaps this Hora'as Sha'a still applies to places and circles where pure Chinuch Torani is not possible, on condition that even there, the learning of Torah is the main occupation and the acquisition of general knowledge is incidental to it. What is their view of what Torah in Derech Eretz was? B'diavad, for sure, right? This is a concession to a particular time, at a particular place. And even Rav Hirsch, if you were alive today, right, according to this, would absolutely not condone, right, condone a secular education, a college education, a liberal arts education. Right? It was something he had to do for a given time under duress, but would not do it again.
But they still, in tzurt, like, I don't know, as what you said last week, doesn't sound like a Chazon Ish would say about Rav Shishon Raphael Hirsch, HaGaon Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Like, they do acknowledge that he was a gadol b'Torah.
They do. They have taken him for that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when I became prum, people did not learn Hirsch in those circles.
Right.
It was not. It's only, I would say, in the last 15 years, maybe 20. But I mean, when I started learning Hirsch, like, people looked at me like I was crazy.
Right.
Like, that's not what you learn when you be in the
frum world.
I wasn't
going to
use the word
frum,
but yes.
That's what they say. Incorrect. I think to some degree it's still true. But figuring this out, because again, the Breuer's world today associates with that world, right? And so figuring out that legacy has become somewhat tricky. What you have below is a description of the art scroll biography on Rav Hirsch. So he's called the architect of Torah Judaism for the modern world. And the description of the book by the publishers goes as follows. In 1851, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch left the chief rabbinate of Moravia, where over 50,000 Jews were under his jurisdiction, to assume the spiritual leadership of the fledgling independent Kehillah of Frankfurt am Main, which could then boast no more than 100 families. The move was to have dramatic consequences not only for the Jews of Frankfurt, but for all of Western Jewry down to our day. Armed only with the force of his personality and the eloquence of his pen, Rabbi Hirsch almost single-handedly arrested 50 years of unbroken ascendancy of reform in Germany. To young German Jews, convinced that their Judaism was nothing more than an obstacle to the fruits of Gentile society, now available to them for the first time, Rabbi Hirsch offered a vision of traditional Judaism of unsurpassed beauty and power. His philosophy of Torah im Derech Eretz is an insistence that the Torah continues to provide the guide to every aspect of life, even after the fall of the ghetto walls. Right? A very different conception of what Torah im Derech Eretz was, of what Rav Hirsch was setting out to do. So, where is the truth? Right? Who was Rav Hirsch? Where would he live? Right. So I think one of my students once told me, like, he'd buy an apartment right somewhere in between. Right? How do we understand Rav Hirsch? How do we understand this community that grew up around him? So to do that, we really need to back up a little bit, because the story of Neo-Orthodoxy does not begin with Rav Hirsch. Doesn't end with him either. The story of Neo-Orthodoxy seems to begin with a man that we know very little about. So if anybody in here is interested in doing a PhD in Jewish history, that's it, right? Rav Avraham Bing is somebody who needs to be studied at length. Nobody has done so yet. Here's what we know about Rav Avraham Bing. We know that several of the most influential leaders of German Orthodoxy in the first half of the 19th century started with him. He was an Av based in a city called Würzburg, in southern Germany. We know that in In the 1840s, I believe, there were 67 rabbis that we know of who had PhDs. 67 rabbis that have PhDs, which is a totally new phenomenon, right, to the world of Judaism. 67 rabbis with a PhD, and I believe 9 of them studied with Rav Bing. So we don't know much about him himself, what his upbringing was. He wrote, I believe we have one piece of his writing, a commentary, I think, on Shulchan Aruch, but we have nothing else that's come down to us. Here's what we do know. We do know that he had several very, very influential students who will almost single-handedly sort of change the arc of orthodoxy in Western Europe, and as you'll see, will ultimately influence what comes after Western Europe. Let's go back to 1818 for a moment. We told the story, right, of this new Israelite temple association that wants to start. It wants to make certain changes, sermon in German, certain prayers in German. They want to have an organ that's played on Shabbos but by a non-Jew. They want to take out references to Shivat Zion, to going back to the land of Israel. The Hamburg Beis Din doesn't want to allow them to open this. They don't want them to be able to petition for legitimacy to the Hamburg Senate. And so they need to prove that this is not real Judaism. And so they write these letters asking for support from others, other big names in the world of Torah Judaism from Western and Central Europe. So how does the story end?
They get rejected. They say, we're not following you.
Who does?
The Gedolim they reach out to.
No, the Gedolim, sorry. The Hamburg Beis Din reaches out to these Gedolim, right, to back them up, right? And they do. They write these tshuvos, right, that are very forceful. Right? So what happens to the Hamburg Beis? What happens to the Hamburg Temple? The Hamburg Temple actually opens? Huh?
They don't need the building. They go with their own.
Okay, they go with their own. Right, good. Right, but you have a community that's on the verge of fracture, right? So what happens? Does Hamburg actually split into two distinct communities? The answer is no. They actually compromised. How did they compromise? They had an opening in 1821 for a new chief rabbi of the city. And they actually went and found somebody who was palatable to both sides of the community. Who did they choose? They chose a man by the name of Isaac Bernays. Now, if you look at the picture on the top of page 4, top left-hand picture, you can see, first of all, what do you notice about his name?
How come that's a German name?
That's Chacham. You know what? It made me feel a lot better because all those Hebrew words that I couldn't read because they're really English. So now you saw a Hebrew word in English and you couldn't read it. I feel a lot better now. Chacham. Okay?
Is that Bernays French?
Bernays.
Yes.
It's Sephardic.
Okay, yes, right? The term Chacham is a Sephardic, right, term. Good. Why do you think that the Orthodox rabbi of Hamburg would take the title Chacham? Sure, I mean, they're German. There's nobody Sephardic there at all.
They said before that there was another version of the Derech Eretz was Chachma. So that's why he's referring to that Torah Derech Eretz by saying Chacham.
Okay, there's no question that Chacham it suggests a certain worldliness, right? That rabbi does not. Right? Chacham suggests that this is somebody who's, right, broader or more cultural for sure. Right? Anybody remember what was one of the other things that these early Reform synagogues were doing in addition to the things I just mentioned before? Right? They were also changing. Didn't they go to Sfaradit? Remember, they changed the pronunciation to Havarat Sfaradit from an Ashkenazi pronunciation. Why? Because that was seen as more cultured. Right? The Sephardic population was a population that these early German reformers looked to as a more proper way of conducting themselves than they did to the European Jewish model. And so already in the title, you're already beginning to see that there is influence here by those who are looking for something different in their rabbi. Does the picture tell you anything?
The collar.
Oh, the collar. Yeah, yeah. Jump a page, right? To page 5.
Your verse is also wearing the same collar.
Indeed he is. And now look at page 5. What did I do here?
Oh, you showed us all of the Protestant groups with their collars.
And what's on the other side? Huh? Rabbanim from where?
From Press.
Primarily from West, from Eastern Europe, right? And then, yes, that's the Chassam Sofer's son, right? Avram Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, right? Can you see the difference in the dress? So now, Chacham Bernays and Rav Hirsch, who do they look more similar to?
To these worldly Protestant religions.
Right, for sure. No question about it. They dressed a certain way. They looked a certain way. Right? They were taking on, these were people who were taking on, right, a certain element of the culture around them well before. Right? Now here we're still talking about Chacham Bernays. Rav Hirsch is not, Rav Hirsch was born in 1808. Right? Chacham Bernays ascends, he becomes the rabbi of Hamburg in 1821. So you can already see that even the traditional community in Hamburg has a certain affinity towards somebody who is going to be, has more of a modern bent to him, somebody who can communicate. Chacham Bernays was university educated. He wrote a review of a work of almost Bible criticism in a Protestant theology journal. He wrote it in German. I have this for you. Heinrich Heine, who was a great intellectual German intellectual of the 19th century, born a Jew and then converted. He says as follows. He once went to Chacham Bernays' shul in Hamburg. And so Chacham Bernays, amongst the other things he started to give a sermon. And he gave a sermon in German, right, in an Orthodox shul. And so Heinrich Heine went one day, and he writes afterwards about Chacham Bernays that he is an ingenious man who has more spirit within him than Dr. Clay, Salomon, Auerbach the first and second. Those are references to leaders of the Reform Shul, right? And saying that Chacham Bernays is a more impressive orator and thinker than they are. Yet he writes, none of the Jews understand him. Now, that wasn't quite the case. We can certainly know of one young Jew growing up in the shul of Chacham Bernays in Hamburg, right, who seemed to understand him quite well.
Rav Hirsch.
Exactly. Right? Rav Hirsch is born in Hamburg. He's born in 1808. So what does he live through as a young boy?
The forming of the Hamburg Temple.
The Hamburg Temple controversy. He's 10. Right? Is he old enough to weigh in? No. Is he old enough to understand, to hear what's going on at the dinner table, at the Shabbos table? Right? To pick up on some of the communal politics? For sure he is. Right? And then, 1821, so now he's a little bar mitzvah boy. Right? And this impressive, modern, yet traditional, right, rabbi comes to town. Right, who is staunchly against any kind of changes to halacha, to the siddur, to anything of that sort, but yet at the same time is fluent in German, he's university educated, he calls himself chacham, he's interested in biblical study, in Bible study, in study of chumash, which again is not happening much in Eastern Europe. And these are all things that are really interesting to him and without a doubt, right, are going to impact the young Samson Raphael Hirsch as well. Chacham Bernays was a student of Rav Avram Bing. Rav Avram Bing has another student, a man by the name of Yaakov Ettlinger. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger leaves the yeshiva of, or the klaus of Rav Avram Bing to start his own, what's known as a klaus or a klois, a small yeshiva in the city of Mannheim. In 1825, so 1821, Chacham Bernays takes over in Hamburg. 1825, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger goes to this yeshiva in Mannheim, and then in 1836, he opens a yeshiva in a city called Altena. Anybody know? Anybody been to Germany? Anybody been to Hamburg? No. Okay. If you go to the city of Hamburg today, you will find that there is a district in the city of Hamburg known as Altena. And today it is a single city. Back then, Altena was actually under Dutch control, Danish control. But they were literally cities that were right across the river from each other, Hamburg and Altena. Now, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, of any of the group on this page, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was probably the last Western European Talmudist recognized in the yeshivos of Eastern Europe. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is the author of several Sfarim, but his most famous is his parish on Shas, known as the Aruch Laner. He's known as the Aruch Laner. Right? His work to this day is studied, whereas you said there are some people, right, who may not be studying Rav Hirsch. Every yeshiva in the world has an Aruch Laner in its, you know, on the shelf. He was an excellent Talmudist and really the last of the great Western European Talmudists, because Western European Orthodoxy, German Orthodoxy, is going to begin to look a little bit different, right, than Eastern European Orthodoxy. But nonetheless, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger shared certain things. First of all, he was university educated also. He, just like Chacham Bernays went to Frankfurt, and he took over a school that had been started by a man by the name of Rav Mendel Frankfurter. Rav Mendel Frankfurter has a grandson whose name is Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. But he took over the school started by Rav Mendel Frankfurter, and they were teaching secular studies in that school in Hamburg. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger comes to Altena. He too starts a school for young kids that has both secular studies and general studies in it. In fact, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger actually had a plan to start a rabbinical seminary that was going to incorporate the two of them. Now, it never came to fruition because of donors that didn't come through, but the idea was clearly there. Yeah, no, exactly, nothing's changed. For 1 year, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger had a student in his yeshiva by the name of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. So Samson Raphael Hirsch has his local rabbi, who's an influence on him? Man by the name of Chacham Bernays, and goes to actually learn. The entirety of his time in yeshiva was 1 year, learning with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. He also spent a year in university. That was it. Also, University of Bonn. He went for 1 year. That's it. He does not have a doctorate, unlike some of these others. Okay, so all roads lead back to Rav Avraham Bing. Rav Avraham Bing has these two students: Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Chacham Bernays, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Is a product of both of them, as is a man by the name of Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer goes to study with Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger in his yeshiva in Altena. Altena is across the river from Hamburg. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer would go for Shabbos over to Hamburg to hear this unique Rav, right, who would speak, give these German sermons, who was extremely enlightened, educated. Rav Israel Hildesheimer also begins to learn from both of these two men, Chacham Isaac Bernays and Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. So let's follow now the career of these two young rabbis, both products of the same two people, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch and Rav Israel Hildesheimer. So Rav Hirsch, if you look at the little box next to his name, and of course, right, when you look, by the way, if you look back at the... at the art school biography. The picture I chose is not the picture they chose for the cover of the book. Right? Everybody noticed that? Right? This is, and they're both pictures of him. This is a picture from later in life, right? In which it looks, his dress is a little bit different, right, than it was as a younger man, right, where he had a beard, but there was no mustache, right? Which was, again, a common fashion of the time. And you can see that he's clearly wearing the canonical collar, right, with the two strips that come down. So Rav Hirsch and Rav Hildesheimer. So Rav Hirsch gets an early start. He is a brilliant young man, takes to things really quickly. Again, he only spends a year in university, spends a year learning in yeshiva. He's already a pulpit rabbi by the age of 21. He goes through a series of smaller appointments until in 1847 he is appointed the rabbi of a city called Nikolsburg and the chief rabbi of the entire area of known as the Moravia. Okay. That's his first major position in 1847. He had already begun writing his most influential works in the 1830s. 1836, he writes a work called The 19 Letters. Right? The 19 Letters is a work that tells of a fictional conversation, a mail correspondence between a young man who's trying to find his way in this newly changed world, and a rabbi, right, who's giving him guidance as to how to answer some of these bigger questions. And then his second work, everybody know what that one was called? Choreif. Right? It's now a school,
Shmuel,
right?
Yeah, I went to that school.
Right. So what was Choreif the work? Do you know?
What was
the book? So the work Choreif goes through every mitzvah in the Torah and gives an explanation behind it. It tells you, right, why it's there and sort of gives you the relevance of the work. So he's already established himself as a writer. In 1847, he becomes the rabbi of Nicholsburg. Rabbi Shmuel Hildesheimer, let's follow him. Right, so he also has several smaller positions until by 1851 he becomes the rabbi of a city called Eisenstadt, right, which a position that he takes from 1851 to 1869. In Eisenstadt, Rabbi Shmuel Hildesheimer opens the first yeshiva, the first post-elementary school that incorporates general studies into the curriculum. So a yeshiva for boys that was learning both Torah and general studies. If you remember in the last lecture, we read a tshuva from the Maharam Shik. Maharam Shik was one of the great students of Chassam Sofer. The Maharam Shik's tshuva was the one he wrote to the person. The person asked him, my job, right, requires, right, that I teach in this shul, right, and they're making these changes. You know, what should I do? And what does the Maharam Shik answer? You gotta leave. Tough luck. You know, quit the job. God, you know, Hashem Yazor. Right? The Maharam Shik sent his son to learn with Rav Israel Hildesheimer, right, in Eisenstadt, in that yeshiva. Okay, he had many of the great gedolim of Central Europe sent their kids to study in his yeshiva because he was that impressive himself. But let's pause there for a second and let's turn to page. Well, let's start on page 6. On page 6, you see a map of the German lands. Right? There was no united Germany in the 18-teens, 1820s, 1830s. Germany was the biggest piece of what we would call today Germany was a country known as Prussia. And then the rest of it were these smaller states, independent states. It won't be until 1871 that Germany becomes united as a single country. But you can see that the cities that we're talking about here, where this is happening, you see Hamburg all the way up here in the north, right? And I typed in a little Altena on top of it, right? Hamburg, Altena, same general region. So that's where the real controversy happens up here in Hamburg. You can see Berlin right there in the center of Prussia, right? So that's a little bit southeast of Hamburg. Those are the areas that are become the hotbed of reformist type of activity. Okay. Now, turn the page one more time. And I apologize for the small print here. I'll tell you what it's the visual that's more important than anything. Okay, don't worry about it. You see the two red circles? Right. You see the two red circles? Good. In between the two red circles is a blue circle. That blue circle is around a city called Pressburg. Right, Pressburg today, Bratislava. Pressburg was home to whom? Excellent, the Chassam Sofer. And that's where the Chassam Sofer had his yeshiva. It was the largest yeshiva in Central or Western Europe by far. Right? So that's where the Chassam Sofer, that's where he that's where the real strength of the anti-reform movement was coming from. Remember how we said, though, that in the time of the Chassam Sofer, there was no reformist activity anywhere in his region at all. Right? He was fighting a fight back up in Germany, and he became the voice for that fight. And then ultimately, his students will move out to the Carpathian Mountains. Those are the arrows that go out there. The two cities that
the highlands.
Yeah, it's actually the verse. They were topographically high, right? But they were known as the Unterland, right? As the lowland. The two cities that I circled there, one is Munkach, and the other is Satmar. Okay. Now again, those are Hasidic right, centers, but we also know that even as far as Hasidic centers go, those are the ideology of those two communities is definitely one we would associate with this sort of ultra-Orthodox position of nothing changes, right, of ultra-conservatism. And that's where the students of the Chassam Sofer will go as well. So there were two red circles there as well. Okay. The two red circles, the one on top, that's Nikolsburg. 1851, who's the rabbi? Sorry, 1847, who's the rabbi in Nikolsburg? Samson Raphael Hirsch. The bottom one is the closest city to Eisenstadt. Who's the rabbi in Eisenstadt by 1850s? Huh? Exactly, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. So by 1850s, who is now on Hungarian or Austro-Hungarian soil and beginning to make inroads?
The Neo-Orthodox.
Right? Rav Hirsch, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. I mentioned last time that the controversy that really set things off in the 1860s amongst these students, or even the generation after the students of the Chassam Sofer, was that the Austro-Hungarian government was considering opening their own rabbinical seminary. Right? Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, there were two ways to play this. Nobody wanted, none of the Orthodox community wanted a state-sponsored seminary. They wanted control of their own seminaries, but there are always two ways to play it. And either you can oppose it, or you can try to co-opt it, right? Or take control of it. And so that's where the students of the Maharam Shik and others, right, fought it. And Rav Yaakov Ettlinger took a different approach. He said, no, you know what? I'm going to try to take over it. They'll give me control of it because, after all, Yaakov Ettlinger he's university educated, right? He has a different kind of background. And so his hope was, if I can't get rid of it, I may as well take leadership of it so that I can make sure that it stays within the boundaries of the Orthodox community. But to that, right, this community in the Ortolan begins to respond. Right? No, that was himself selling himself out. Right? That was proof to this community that, in fact, what they were seeing, and it makes so much sense. Right? If we're in the 1850s or the 1860s in the Unterland, where the students of the Chassam Sofer, and we're looking at Rav Hirsch and Rav Ettlinger, what are we saying to ourselves? What do they look like? What are they doing?
They look like the first reformers.
Oh, very good. They look like the reformers from
the Hamburg Temple.
Yeah, from the 1810s, from the 1820s. We've seen this movie already. Right? We know how this ends. Right? So yes, today it's your canonicals, right? The clothing you're wearing. And it's the German sermon. And it's the choir in your show. But you know what it's going to be tomorrow? Yes, right. Mixed dancing, right? And then eating pork. Right? We've seen this story already. We know how this ends. And so it is to the infiltration of the Neo-Orthodox community, right, into the world of Austro-Hungary that the ultra-Orthodox community begins to respond and say, wait a minute, you can't even go there. Don't be seduced by Yafet Torah im Derech Eretz, because that's just a one-way ticket out, right? Because we've seen this play itself out already. Okay, so now we better understand the response to the Neo-Orthodox. So what exactly, how does this story play out? Neither Rav Hirsch nor Rav Ettlinger ever see a long-term future for themselves in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So although the art school biography tells a little bit differently, that he had this really prestigious position in Nikolsburg in Moravia that he gave up in order to come to this small little community in Frankfurt. It's not exactly that way. There was reason for Rav Hirsch, right, who was a person who had a vision, right, and he could see what was, he knew that the future for him and his training and his background wasn't going to be in Austro-Hungary, it was going to be in the German lands. Now, to explain, though, where Rav Hirsch came to and sort of what he was thinking, we need to tell one more sort of piece of this story. Let me just check the time. Ooh, late. Okay. All right. Let's talk first about the ideology of Rav Hirsch. The ideology of Torah im Derech Eretz. Where did it come from, right, and what did it mean? So on page 8... you have a letter that Rav Hirsch wrote in which he was explaining this work, Chorev, that he was about to publish to a friend of his, explaining why he wrote this work And what I want you to do as you're listening to me read this letter is try to think not about this work, but what does this description of the work tell you about the world of Western European Jewry, of Western European Orthodox Jewry, at the time in the 1830s. As regards the purpose of the present work, I'm in the first paragraph that on the left-hand column. You seem to have grasped it well, again on page 8, from the very outset. I must admit that I have tried to walk in paths which have not been trodden for 3 to 4 centuries. I am prepared for rebuke, bitter rebuke, and even abuse. Yosef, how old is he now?
Who is it?
This is Rapersh, and this is 1835.
Some early 20s, late teens.
Well, so he was born in 1808.
Oh, I thought he was born later. Okay, so that's
right?
It's like
27, right? Okay, so he's 27 years old. And so he's still somewhat of an upstart, right? And here he is writing a work that he thinks is going to save all, you know, the Jewish people. So I am prepared for rebuke, bitter rebuke, and even abuse. I am not expecting approval or fame, although I never attack real or imaginary persons. In fact, I do not attack at all. Only compile, develop, point away, and see truth. Where I think I have found it, I try to bring it home to my readers. Generally, I only try to think aloud and ahead, and I should feel rewarded if people did not disdain to follow my thoughts. But there are people who almost consider it an impertinence that in 1835 one is still exhorted to think about certain matters. Such people will reproach me bitterly because they are being disturbed in their calm. However, these people do not belong to the trend of thought of our century, the 19th century. In the last 50 years, it has been clearly noticeable that trends of thought only enter Jewish circles when they have already become obsolete elsewhere. Our century wants to think, and that is its greatest merit. Whatever can be rationally explained and is capable of being presented as idea and concept and can stand the test of rational thinking has nothing to fear. But one can only analyze, test, and meditate upon things with which one is acquainted. Among Jews, however, nothing is less well known than Judaism itself. I dare to submit Judaism as it appears to me to intellectual analysis. I shall perhaps be blamed for it from all sides. But just because of that, I must not and will not be silent.
This is a very critical time where they're analyzing everything.
If I knew of even one person more capable than myself of pleading the true cause for Israel, my incapable and inexperienced pen would have rested for a long time yet. As it is, however, I see an older generation in which Judaism has become an inherited mummy. A generation which shows veneration for Judaism, it is true, but a veneration without spirit. Some of that generation, therefore, see only tombstone inscriptions in Judaism, and thus despair of the eternal validity of the only thing that makes life worth living. On the other hand, I see a younger generation aglow with noble enthusiasm for Judaism, or rather for Jews. These young men do not know authentic Judaism, and what they believe they know of it, they consider as empty forms without meaning. One must admit, however, that this ignorance is not entirely their fault, and thus the young generation is in danger of undermining Judaism while striving for Jews. What's happened in the 1830s? What is he seeing in the 1830s?
The yeshiva that was...
He's seeing life in the reform movement.
Huh?
He's seeing life in the reform. But they're exuberant.
They're not even reform anymore. They're just leaving Judaism. They're not thinking of Judaism anymore. That's
kind of... Well, let's get our chronology, though, right. We're in the 1830s. The reform movement hasn't even coalesced into a movement yet. That's the 1840s. He's not describing reform Jews. He's describing Jews. The roots may be in the Haskalah, which was already 50 years earlier, right, the end of the 18th century. But he's describing a community. Forget it, traditional, not Jews, plain old Jews in Western Europe. They don't know anything about Judaism. Right? They see Judaism as a mummy, as a relic of the past. No wonder Reform communities are having some success, right? And because there's nothing there. They don't feel any connection to Judaism. Hey, and so, you know what Horeth is? Horeth, which is the work that he's describing?
Har Sinai.
is, you know, what, this book is the first work of Kirov. That's what it is. It's the first work of Kirov. It's the first time that a rabbi sees, I have an entire community who is, they don't know, they have to be brought back. Right? But again, but the fact that they have to be brought back already by the 1830s tells you that this has been going on for some time already. There have been decades in which this post-French revolutionary, a Jewish community, has been raised in this new enlightened world, and they are drifting pretty significantly, right, away from Torah. And so he saw his role as bringing Torah to them. Flip the page. Top of page 9. From this comes from the 19 letters. And as for the religious training of the young, which should be the bearer of all our hopes for the future, how does it fare? What does Jewish education look like in the 1830s for German Jews? Our religious schools are like all the other institutions of learning of the present days. Our young are made thoroughly capable of contending vigorously in the struggle for a livelihood. The trades, commerce, the arts and sciences, all these are carefully inculcated and the mind developed. Although even in this regard, more attention is paid to the mere training of the memory than to the cultivation of habits of thought. But what about the education of the heart, the cultivation of Judaism? Where is the school that is imbued with the Jewish spirit, so that the spirit may also inspire the lives of its students? What about the rearing of human beings who will see themselves as creatures living in a divine world and endowed with powers belonging to God, which they are to dedicate to the fulfillment of God's will? Where are the young men and women? Note that, in the 1830s. Where are the young men and women who will rejoice in the mission, in their mission, and who will be imbued with fiery love for the name Jew, which summons them to such a way of life to fulfill the divine law amidst perils, suffering, and privations, who comprehend the world, the past, the present, and themselves as cornerstones in the edifice of the future? If you can't tell, Rav Hirsch is an incredibly talented communicator. Right? And from what I understand, in his German, it's that much better. Right? He's incredibly powerful. He has a way with words, both spoken and written, right, that reaches a generation, but a generation which you can see is gone, right? Or on the verge of being gone. There's no, the schools aren't inspiring kids. There's a whole generation that's grown up that feels detached from kids. And so he captures that at the beginning of the 19 letters, the bottom of page 9. Benjamin says to Naphtali, thus I've always wondered more than a little how you, this is the young student writing to this rabbi, right? The rabbi is the fictional Rav Hirsch, right? Thus I have always wondered how, more than a little how you, who know how to appreciate the beauties of Virgil, Tasso, and Shakespeare, and can fathom the logical edifices of Leibniz and Kant, can find pleasure in the formless, tasteless writings of the Old Testament, or in the illogical disputations of the Talmud.
So we're trying to say that these kids don't realize the Torah, and they're getting essentially bored.
They're getting bored, right? Or they see excitement and intellectual challenge and beauty in the non-Jewish world, right? But they don't see anything of the sort in the Jewish world. And that was Rav Hirsch's goal. That was his goal, was to show this community that Torah actually is worth keeping. Right? That it still has validity, that it still has relevance. So, going back to this idea of Torah im Derech Eretz.
So he really did mean Derech Eretz, not Mada, or not Torah for the real world. I mean,
why do you say that?
Because he wanted to show the beauty of Judaism in terms of being a good person, but not necessarily really Mada and...
See, I don't think so. I think he meant Mada. I think he meant Tasso and Shakespeare. And Leibniz and Kant. I think he meant all that. But I think that the chiddush, the innovation in Torah im Derech Eretz, is not where we traditionally put it. The chiddush was not Derech Eretz. The chiddush was Torah.
Is that mechazeket what the
yes,
part.
Yes.
It sounds more right than what we see.
Except that I do not think he thought it was Horat Shah. I do not think he wrote several times. Right? We read it in the beginning. He believed that Jews had engaged in secular culture for years. He looked at people like the Rambam as having led that charge, and if we couldn't do it, we can't do it now, it's because because our oppressors didn't allow us to do it. So I don't think he thought it was Bidi Evet. I don't think he thought that secular
secular studies with something that we have to do because we have to make a living. He specifically says that's not the case. But what is true, and this is what leads to the confusion, is that he didn't have to convince anybody that secular studies was worth living or learning. That was taken for granted in the world of Western European Jewry. Remember, he's three generations after Ravin. Right? Ravin was already had students who were going to university. Chacham Bernays was already, as Rav Hirsch was growing up, was university educated, speaking in German. These were givens in the world of Western European Jewry. Comes along Rav Hirsch in the 1830s, and then when he finally comes back to Frankfurt in the 1850s, and says, wait a minute, you've lost the other piece. The Torah seems to be gone. It's on the verge. We have to save that. Yafeh Torah im Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. The chidush is that Torah can still be saved. I know it's late. I want to add one more point to this important story. I apologize. But there's one more important piece of Rav Hirsch's legacy that also helps explain how he is understood in the contemporary society. So the description of the biography says that he comes back in 1847, to this community in Frankfurt that they said had no more than, 100 families? Is that what they said? No. You think that Frankfurt only had 100 Jewish families in 1848? No, definitely not. So let me tell you what was happening. By the time we get to the 1840s, these reform groups are beginning to coalesce. More and more of these shuls begin to emerge. And a problem sets in. The problem is that in most of Western Europe, the Jewish community was an official organ of the government. That is, there was no such thing as secular space. You couldn't be a secular person. When you were born, your parents had to register you as part of a faith community of some sort. And through that faith community is how you determined what kinds of privileges you got or didn't get. The community generally had the right, bestowed by the government, to raise taxes internally, that is, to raise funds for the communal infrastructure, and then to spend them as the community saw fit. So what do you think happens by the 1830s and the 1840s? What kind of communal politics do you think begin to emerge? And what are they fighting over? People and money. Right? And money. Right? So the rabbi, the shochet, the mikvah, right? All of these things are under communal control and communal dollars. Now, if I happen to be in a community that is predominantly more traditional, then I, as a more reform-leaning Jew, say, wait a minute, why am I paying for institutions that I'm not using? Right? I belong to this newer shul, right? I don't want to have to pay for that shochet, that mikvah, that shul that I'm not a part of. Right? And then the reverse will happen. You'll find certain communities where the tendency towards reform really has the majority, and then the Orthodox find themselves in a place where, how can I possibly give money to support this rabbi who I don't even follow him, right? I can't trust his, or by the time you get to the 1840s, a rabbi who doesn't hold of halacha in certain areas, what is that? And how could it be that I can have to continue to support such a thing? It was the 1840s in Frankfurt that a small group gets together and petitions for the right to start their own shul. Because the rabbi of the city was more reform-leaning. This was a group of traditional Jews who said, we don't want to dominate this person's shul. We want the right to start our own shul. They were granted that right. The name of this group, Kahal Adas Yeshurun. Right? Kahal Adas Yeshurun. I heard some ahas. Why did I hear ahas? Oh, and where is the shul with that name? No, not in Jerusalem. In Washington Heights. Yes, there's one in but in Washington Heights, the Breuer shul is known as Kahal Adas Yeshurun. Right, that was the name of this community that broke away from the major reform community to start its own community. They broke away first. They got permission to break away. Now they need a rabbi. Right? Now they need a rabbi. And so they bring Rav Hirsch, right? Who better, right, to lead that charge than somebody who can beat them at their own game? Right? Who can who's who's actually a better orator, a better writer, right, highly educated, to lead this group in Frankfurt. And in fact, he will grow this, yes, it was maybe 100 families when he got there, right, but he will start building institutions and schools and schools, and will build something very impressive and very large and very strong, right, in Frankfurt. A few years later, the community in Berlin does something similar. They too break away because the dominant force in Berlin has become the Reform Movement. They break away, create Kahal Hadas Yisrael, a sister community to Kahal Hadas Yeshurun. They too need a rabbi. Who do they select? Rav Israel Hildesheimer. Right, not Ettlinger, but Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who had been in Eisenstadt. There's no future for his vision of Orthodoxy in Hungary, so he comes to Berlin. And now we have Rav Hirsch and Rav Hildesheimer, right, leading separate communities. Now, Rav Hildesheimer starts a yeshiva. He was not a pulpit rabbi the way that Rav Hirsch was. He starts a yeshiva. He now is able to create the yeshiva that his Rebbe had in mind, the Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, a yeshiva that trains rabbis, a seminary, a rabbinical seminary, the first rabbinical seminary, right, that was going to insist that all rabbinical students also get a general studies education. And he creates that in Berlin in the 1850s. To take the Rav Hirsch story just to its logical end, this secession of this group from of the Orthodox from the larger community, something known as Austritt. Austritt means to secede. So they succeeded in doing that, but they still had a financial problem. Right? The financial problem was what?
They're not getting funded by the
government. They're still paying, right? For all these other institutions that they're not, right? Good. In 1871, the German states are united under Otto von Bismarck. And one of the first things that the government will do is look at the laws of secession. Right? They were not interested in, it wasn't the Jews that were driving this, it was Catholics and Protestants, right, that were driving this. And they passed a law in 1871 that allowed for people to secede from or to leave the community that they had been registered in by birth. Right? 1871, you're now allowed to leave your faith community. The only caveat, though, was that you had to publicly renounce your faith in your belonging to this community. And so, for a Protestant, it meant I have to say I'm no longer Protestant, now I'm free to go wherever I want. I can be nothing, I can join the Catholic Church, whatever I want. Catholics, same kind of thing. Problem was, though, to the government, there was only one kind of Judaism. Right? So to get out of my communal obligations to pay taxes to the community, I would have to stand up and say I'm not Jewish. Right? And nobody in that community wanted to do such a thing. Rav Hirsch will spend the next 2 years fighting, right, advocating in the German government that this is unfair and it discriminates against Jews, and he will win. So that in 1873 they will change the law again, and it's actually seen as a critical moment in the separation of church and state in the development of Germany as a whole. That's the story of Rav Hirsch. The story of Rav Hirsch is one, so with it, he becomes known for two things. For Torah im Derech Eretz, which again is not quite the way people spin it today, but it's this idea that we can still have Torah, even though we have Derech Eretz, but he also becomes known for his fight to separate from the Reform community, to create a more isolationist type of community, right? because economically they had to, right? So it's understood why today, right? On the one hand, you have people in the Torah Umada world, right, claiming that he's the architect of their ideology. On the other hand, there are those in the more isolationist, you know, more, for lack of a better word, Haredi world, who say, wait a minute, no, Rav Hirsch was the great, yes, he allowed Derech Eretz at a certain time, but he was the great fighter against the Reform movement, separating the Orthodox community from its entanglements in the Reform community. Okay, lastly, what happens with Rav Ettlinger? Rav Ettlinger starts this yeshiva in Berlin, becomes the first yeshiva, training rabbis, new modern, Orthodox rabbis, right? Rabbis that were getting a secular education and a true Orthodox education. If you look back at the pictures on page 4, so you can see that Rav Hildesheimer will ultimately hand over the reins of his yeshiva to Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman had been a student of his, I believe, in Eisenstadt. Now that he's in Berlin, he brings Rav David Tzvi Hoffman over. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman is a great Torah scholar, a Chumash scholar. He writes a really important Sefer on Chumash, answering biblical criticism, things that people were saying about the historicity of the Torah. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, under his tutelage, under his reign as the head of this yeshiva, the yeshiva becomes known as the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Yeshiva in Berlin. Ultimately, the reins will pass from Rav David Tzvi Hoffman to Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg in 1924. The Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary is led by Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberger, known for his collection of tshuvot that he wrote, known as the Sri Dei Eish. Why do I tell you that? Because in 1926, a young Polish boy from a famous, storied rabbinical family in Poland will come to Berlin to do his PhD, right, at the University of Berlin. And in 1926, he will register to audit courses at the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. And that young man was? Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Right? So Rabbi Soloveitchik, who will later then come to the United States, right, and become the gadol of the world of centrist orthodoxy, Yeshiva University, Torah Umada, it has his first entryway into this world. Now, again, he was clearly living there before. He came to study university, right? But he will bring this world of Lithuanian learning and Talmud study and combine it with the world of German Orthodoxy that he encounters in this world of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, puts the two together. From there, it gets transplanted to the United States, and that's where the world of modern Orthodoxy is born. Okay?
Would you have a chance at any time